Okay, we're going to get started. This next presentation on test vector leakage assessment for side channel analysis and conformance testing scenario is going to be done in two parts by two different people. First, we're going to have Gilbert Goodwill Sr. He's a principal engineer at Cryptography Research, now a part of Rambus. And the second part's going to be done by Steve Wyman, a security engineer at InfoGuard. Thank you very much.
Hi, everybody. So yeah, the format here is the idea is there's a methodology that was developed by us at Cryptography Research looking at side channel and trying to find a way to make side channel testing work in a conformance environment. And so that's sort of your theory practitioners in one specific cryptography area. And then Steve is going to present how the experience of actually using that and absorbing that testing methodology works in practice. So you'll get to see sort of a idea and how its adoption in a real testing environment work and where some of the weaknesses are and where some of the places that we need more input. So what is test vector leakage assessment? It is an idea to look at side channel analysis. Who knows what side channel analysis is? Okay, a few hands there. Briefly, if you make a device and you use a very secure cipher, you use an AES, you use an elliptic curve, an RCC, you think you've got good building blocks, you make yourself a secure device, and everything you send out of that device, you encrypt. There's only ciphertext visible outside. Then you think you've made a very secure system. The problem is that your assumptions are actually faulty. Things go out of your secure device that you don't intend to go out, and those come from the device actually operating. As it operates and uses power to do its computations, it uses different amount of power to do different things. And that information goes outside of your secure border. Similarly, that changing amount of power in those little tiny wires inside your processor has some degree of radiation, electromagnetic, that comes out of it and propagates. And so you can actually get information outside of a tamper-resistant shell that is relating to the secret that's being manipulated on the inside. If it's directly the secret itself, we call that simple power analysis. If you can look at one power trace and read off the secret key, that's a one, that's a zero, that's a one, that's a zero, being processed because the secret key is being used in an algorithm in such a fashion, that's what we call simple power or simple EM analysis. Differential power analysis or differential EM analysis looks at a whole set of operations and says, by and large, Are these traces using a little bit more power or a little less power than others? And you'll need thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of traces to test that. And that'll depend on the security level you put in place. So side channel analysis is a way that a device is leaking information about what's going on inside of it that is unintended but is based upon manipulations using the key. And it's not so much a fault of the algorithm like AES or elliptic curve, as it is of the assumption that these are just not the black boxes that they were designed to be. So what can you do about that? Well, there are methods to deal with it, and how can you test it is the focus here. So up until a few years ago, when people tested for side channel analysis, they essentially went after the system as if they were an attacker. And that would take a great deal of time. You need to go in and say what algorithm is running on the device, what kind of attacks could work against this algorithm, and essentially, like a penetration tester, try all of these different techniques to see if you could get in and extract the key from the device as it's running. So that took algorithm-specific knowledge. That meant that you had to keep up to date with the latest attacks. If I'm going to field a device and this lab knows about attack A and there's suddenly an attack A prime, that lab would give a better test and have the devices that were checked for that new vulnerability would be better tested. And it really meant that people had to try right and wrong key guesses to get inside a device and see whether it leaked or whether it actually had the key exploitable from it. When conformance testing started to come around and say, well, can we do any sort of side channel testing? We've looked at FIPS 140-2 for a long time now, and it does have a section that describes what side channel analysis is. This is section 4.11, mitigation of other attacks, except it's sort of vendor discretion. If they document that they have those type of protections, then the lab is to test for those protections. But in general, there's not been a lot of testing in the conformance environment that is shorter time frames. So if you're going to do penetration testing and beat up against a device, you might take weeks, months to do an evaluation. If you're going to do validation conformance testing, you're going to spend days, weeks evaluating a device. Can you do anything about side channel analysis in that time scenario? So that's what test vector leakage assessment was developed to do. So instead of going against a device as a black box, like an attacker, which is essentially tying one hand behind your back, go at it knowing the values that are going to be manipulated on a device. It uses specified test vectors. Choose the values that the device is going to work. Choose the keys. Choose the data. Put that through the device. Now no longer are you trying to attack this device and see, can I tell a wrong key from a right key? Instead, I know the right key. Can I see any of the things that an attacker would use to exploit on this device? Are they visible? Does it leak information that's exploitable for an attack? So that's where test vector leakage assessment comes from, is trying to use some of those things that you might see in a program like cryptographic algorithm validation. The test vectors know, oh, when you do AES or you do RSA, did you handle this special test case where you might have a message that does this or matches these certain criteria? All that knowledge gets put into the test vector, so the tester doesn't have to know as much about the algorithm. Now the tester runs the system. I don't have to be a tester who knows all the latest and greatest attacks. My test vectors take care of that. And my test vectors test for exploitable intermediates. And if I see leakage for them, I know that this device is vulnerable. So that's one of the bases of test vector leakage assessment, is known values in, look for leakage versus trying to do a penetration type test. One of the other things that came into play with looking at doing a standardized testing is being able to really say what's a pass-fail criteria. When I started doing side channel analysis, and this is not even going back that far, maybe more than 5 years ago, people would generally look at traces and look and try to distinguish a right key guess from a wrong key guess based on the height of a spike. And this is the result of taking traces on an oscilloscope, bringing them into a workstation and processing them. And, oh, how high is your spike? Okay. But the noise would decrease over time, and eventually it would reveal the spikes for a right or wrong key guess. A wrong key guess, the noise would just decrease. A right key guess, the noise would decrease, and eventually I'd be able to tell a right from a wrong answer. But where was the threshold? How could I tell that I had a right key guess versus a wrong key guess? When we started to look at leakage, not right versus wrong, but is there some information there, we needed some criteria that said instead, after I have collected X amount of data, so a standard says to you, I need 100,000 trace security, I need 1,000,000 trace security, collect that data, start an analysis, and see, do I have confidence to distinguish a leaky value at that level of security? The way that we can measure confidence using statistical math is a t-test. So we brought into play using a Welch's t-test. Now, no longer, instead of noise decreasing over time and showing spikes, we show the spikes growing over time as we get more and more confidence that they're above the noise level. Now we see these spikes grow in terms of standard deviations, and we have a very good pass-fail criteria for a given test, and says after 100,000 traces, I have 99.999% confidence that this device is not leaking this quantity. And we can do that across a whole set of quantities from a single data collect and provide those analysis results. So those are really the foundations of test vector leakage assessment. Having a t-test, a statistical test to tell whether there is leakage, and using known values into the system so that I don't have to guess keys and see whether I'm right or wrong. I know I'm always right. Does anything an attacker use leak out of the system? So we've applied this to a number of ciphers. Originally, it was written up in most detail about AES. So that is sort of the most complete of our set of scripts or specifications of how to do this testing. But recently, we've gone ahead and added DES and triple DES support. In the same way that AES looks at a whole series of intermediates outlined here, S-box output, round outputs, those are all intermediates, values that are computed as you're doing an AES calculation that a partial key guess could then be confirmed right or wrong, and an attacker could extract the key piece by piece without doing a whole 128-bit or 256-bit attack. Those are very similar type quantities that are available for DES and triple DES. The other set of tests here is fixed versus varying. And this is a class of tests that tends to amplify leakage. When I try to attack something specifically going on the system, then I focus in and says, I say, does bit 3 of round output leak? If it does, then an attacker is going to be able to use that. But I'm only looking at one bit out of 128 bits worth of state in AES and seeing whether that makes a difference. All the other things are random and varying, and I'm comparing the average of my traces where I happen to have bit 3 a 1 with a set of traces where I have bit 3 a 0. On the other hand, fixed versus varying and semi-fixed versus varying, instead of looking at single bit leaks, combine together various leaks from multiple bits, from multiple intermediate quantities. So they show leakage earlier. The idea here is that now you've got a testing platform that shows leakage earlier. If I'm a lab, I don't want to test for 3 days if I can see that leakage in just a few hours of data collection. Fixed versus random has been shown to show many orders of magnitude leakage strength higher, which means I can see whether a device is going to pass or fail equivalently in a much earlier amount of time. We'll talk about some of the caveats and downside for that in just a moment. So DES as a block cipher is very similar to AES for this, and we've added support recently for hashing functions, namely SHA-256. Again, we look at the intermediates that are specific to that cipher. In the case of SHA, whether it be used in HMAC or not, we look at the round outputs, we look at the various internal quantities like message schedule, the parts of the state that are being updated that show up in what I call T1 and T2 there. And again, we also do fixed versus varying messages in there. That'll show leakage earlier and allow us to quickly detect a problem on a device. In the public key scenario, things are a little bit different. Generally there, we're not as concerned, or we're not looking at things that, we're looking for anything that varies in terms of timing. And so we've come up with some, what we call semi-fixed versus varying techniques, where by choosing a key and choosing a message, we can make a set of messages and keys, and those traces will have a specific quantity occur at a point in time within them, and then diverge. And then we can choose another set of traces that doesn't have that quantity within it. And we can see if there is leakage when we compare those two sets. Again, that's creating data on the system and seeing if differences in that data can be detected outside of the system, differences of data internal to the computation itself. So we've done that technique both for block ciphers as well as for public key, but we focus it mainly on the public key side. A little bit more difficult to do the intermediates. A lot of the work in terms of public key is done on making sure you have fixed timing and first order type leaks, and then there are some second order considerations. So that brings us to sort of the crux of the biscuit, which is what are the problems, or what are the things that I've got a technique now that can show leakage earlier, it's made my testing time shorter because I'm using test vectors, I'm not attacking a system, I'm evaluating it for leakage. Well, what's sort of the downside? And one of the big downsides, or one of the big new skills that has to come in, is being able to see the signal itself. You need to be able to find a power tap or place an EM probe, figure out what kind of filters you need to be able to get a trace that shows this device operating over time. So that's a skill that has to be developed by the testing laboratories. There is definitely a ramp up on that. It takes some time to figure out how that works, how you go about it. You do need to get a little bit familiar with side channel data collection techniques, and then you also need to make sure you're actually getting a signal. So I come to the last bullet on the slide that says absence of signal does not mean absence of leakage. What happens if you do a test and you don't see any leakage? Well, is that because you forgot to plug in your probe or turn on your amplifier? Or is that because the system is really secure? So there are some fail safes in this methodology. We require that you're going to be able to see input and or output leakage. We assume no one's trying to hide the ciphertext that comes out of this device, so you should be able to analyze for leakage of that ciphertext and be able to see it coming out of the cryptographic core. Then you know you're at a place where you can see operations from the cryptographic library or core, and then you can say, oh, my other tests that are looking at intermediates don't show leakage, and I am able to see signal for things that actually do leak and are not protected. Now I have some confidence in what's going on. The signal finding skill does take some time to develop. Does mean some familiarity with signal processing and filters, amplifiers, that type of lab equipment. But once it's developed, it's generic across algorithms. So where you might have had to keep a tester who was familiar with the latest and greatest attacks on RSA, now you have someone who knows about signal processing and can do analysis on lots of different types of ciphers. So it's cipher agnostic to learn how to process signals. But we do want to confirm that the leakage is there. So that comes into what would be called attack potential factors. So if you look at the JIL stuff or the attack potential stuff in PCI or a number of standards and common criteria use this, how much level of effort does this attack take? So that's measured in terms of expertise, knowledge of the device, what type of equipment, parts, are they bespoke parts, are they off-the-shelf parts, what kind of things do I need to do this attack? And that adds up to a score, which is used to say, is this device secure or not? So finding the signal may add into that score, right? I had to spend some time signal hunting, I had to put these filters on, I had to do some extra work, I got my probe past the tamper-resistant shell because I had a test sample, but an attacker might not be able to do that. Those all show up as weighting factors, so that has to be added in. The other area where attack potential factors show up for a TVLA is in terms of the two different classes of tests. I talked about specific tests, bit three of the round output on this cipher for this round. Does it leak or not? If it leaks after 10,000 traces, I know an attacker can extract the key after 10,000 traces. There's complete parity there for those specific tests. But for the other tests I talked about where it's fixed versus random or semi-fixed versus random, it's combining leaks together from multiple bits, multiple bytes. And an attacker is generally not going to have that type of capability on the system and can't exploit those leaks directly. Those leaks are generally the result of combining together lots of single bit leaks. So if a device leaks fixed versus random after 10,000 traces, it'll probably leak a specific intermediate after 100,000 traces. But what's the scaling factor? And can you actually say that with 100% certainty? What if it's leaking some other intermediate that's not one of the ones you were collecting, that an attacker might exploit later, but would take a while to develop an attack? Those are the areas where you need to add in weighting to this again and say, look, this is a place where it might take the attacker a little more effort to go ahead and do this. They would have to go through and develop IC leakage in 10,000 traces, but an attacker would actually real world take them 100,000 traces. IC leakage, but an attacker would actually have to get to the point where they can see that from a single intermediate or develop a new attack. How do I scale those weights? And those are the things where we actually need feedback. Those are places where, as this technique gets adopted, that's the place where labs provide feedback and say, you know, how do we scale this? How does this work in terms of assessing of a testing scenario? So with that in mind, let's see how InfoGuard's real-world experience goes.
I don't know if you probably can't see that Steve Weingart's holding these like instant trending things, you know, you're trending down or you get the hook at the end, you know. And, yeah. So let me get this up. Okay. So I'm Steve Wyman with InfoGuard. A couple things up front, along the lines of I'm not a real doctor, but I play one on TV. In this case, although I have done the training and that type of work and have overseen and been a part of the team's efforts on this, I'm actually not the one who's been doing the testing myself. So I've been doing a little bit of problem solving. We're looking at essentially things that are just moving towards a more generalized program and that type of thing. But you know, I have been enough a part of that to represent pretty well what the team has experienced. Second thing is you'll notice that because Gilbert and I prepared our presentation separately, there's a little bit of overlap, so bear with us on that, but I think that it's really kind of two different perspectives on some of the same material. So in the ideal, I'll cover this quickly, what the CRA is proposing for TVLA is a method that's similar in concept to something that is really fairly plug and chug, an algorithm testing kind of operation, where you can really do a set of things that's standardized, reproducible with prescribed methods, with a controlled test vector suite that you can get updates on so that you stay current, and that there is some level of time bounding. We're not, I think, in this process going to say that these things are absolutely fixed in time, but there's some notion of it being at least bounded in time so that you can, as a lab, accurately give people quotes and things that will help to perform the work. and that it would be feasible for third parties to do this kind of conforming testing on behalf of the people who need it done. So what we see in that is that there are some differences here between the ideal and what we experience. There is a skill set, and I think Gilbert touches on this. It is a more technical skill set. And when we talk about signal exploration and isolation, I think we tend to look at these things as art and skill at this point. This is not something, you really have to kind of build up this expertise. You have to get good at it, and you have to then apply that. I think you have to keep applying that kind of ability over time. So in particular here, when we've been describing signal exploration, it's been the finding of the signal of interest. And so my personal experiences of that have been along the lines of, staring at a pattern of static almost when you see raster displays, and being able to begin to identify what process you go through to actually pick out that signal. And even if you have that background, and I have that background even though it's, 15 years stale and old, you can come back to that kind of thing. But even with that background, you really got to practice that kind of thing. You got to understand what tactics you're going to apply, and know from the team, what has worked before and so on. It's probably fairly hard for somebody to do this within an organization in isolation themselves and not have a team to support them on this kind of thing. The signal isolation is the art of cleaning up the signal. And so if you don't do a good job of that, I think you're going to get a little bit of a garbage in, garbage out kind of result. And so you're going to really need to have some abilities to do filtering, understand that kind of filtering, and understand how to apply that properly. In these toolkits, you will see that there's support for that. And so I really have appreciated, especially coming from a time when I was doing that kind of work in design, and seeing how rapidly you can make and apply filters, and that's great. But it is something where that's going to require some education for the people who are running this type of work for you, and it's going to require that practice. So we've also seen that you need to have some good understanding of the tools. And I say MATLAB here because that's particularly what was being used in this toolkit. But you're going to have to learn how to, get a little education in manipulating the data sets in order to be able to do this well. And, that's not manipulation in terms of changing them, but essentially things that make the do filtering and are searching for the correlation and things of that. You have to be able to do that work over time to understand the best way to go about this process. Now, as this type of program improves and is becoming more standardized, it's possible that those types of things can be so strictly controlled that you don't have to do that. But certainly you're going to want to have the confidence to know that what is being done in that processing is valid and that it's being done correctly. Maybe we disagree a little bit here, I'm not sure. I think it is, in fact, necessary for people to have a pretty good idea of what's happening with the algorithms. You can't really, I think, look at the simple power analysis waveforms and think that you're getting a good idea about what you're doing unless you're really able to recognize what's happening in those algorithms as represented by waveforms. And so that doesn't mean necessarily that, if you cannot get great signal isolation because of just the circumstances, I mean, maybe that implementation of the side channel attack mitigations are working very well. But I think that what you have to be aware of is that when you see AES written up in a standard or triple DES written up in a standard, what you see in a standard is not the way it is implemented. And so there are a variety of implementation methods. When you go looking for that, then if you have that expectation, or if you have, for example, the people that you're training who have that expectation, you need to train them in the various methods that are being used. It's certainly helpful to know from the vendors if they're willing to give you that information or can give you that information, what they have employed. And a part of that, I guess, is that you do have to have people in that process who, or access to people in that process who have the appropriate math background. So we are seeing that we had to have a little bit longer training times to get people to be effective at this than we were originally bargaining for. And in fact, we did initial training. The folks really didn't, we didn't have contracts to do that work right away. And after about three to six months, I think we felt, well, we can't really do this without a refresher course. And we went back to CRI and we took a refresher course just to make sure we had a better handle on the things that we were doing to make sure we were doing a good job. So I think in addition to just getting training, as I've said, I think people have to practice at this. I would make recommendations to have models that you can work on, that you can deploy, some things that you have some control over, so that you can have references to practice with and build up those skills and to propagate those skills amongst the team. So part of that then is the extensive practice that you have to have for proficiency. So another part of this, I think that as we see the regulatory bodies, if they're going to try to accredit labs in practices like this in order to have a compliance program, one of the things that's going to have to happen here is some kind of accreditation process that includes the evaluation of those skills. And that kind of thing isn't necessarily that you're going to get that answer from just kind of a Q&A with a group of people or some kind of easy test that you can administer or anything that may be measurable from looking at artifacts that are people's documents and things like that. Instead, I think there has to be some kind of proficiency examination so that there's at least a baseline of proficiency. There are other places where this kind of thing is done, where they establish proficiency by giving you tests that you have to pass, working with things that are where they know what results to expect and you don't. So something along those lines is going to be necessary, I think, for that accreditation process to be effective. In terms of the interaction with vendors, I think maybe some of this goes without saying, but labs should expect to educate the vendors on goals, process, and conclusions of the process. And I would say, you know, maybe we all do this and as we work with vendors on these regulatory programs anyway, but here I think the task is a little more challenging than the usual. Because I think you're going to have to really be able to explain things well to people. You have to allocate a little more time. The vendors are not going to be aware of the countermeasures, not that you can suggest them to them, but they may not understand what you're presenting to them and the conclusions that you're giving to them. They might, but we've had a little bit of experiences with both ends of that spectrum. There's going to be some level of instrumentation of the system under test. This, I think, in terms of things like triggers or the ability to get information in and out. And this is always the case with this kind of thing. I think we've struggled a little less here than I might have thought. It's nice to have things with reliable triggers without creating a lot of extra jitter that, you know, just exacerbates the problem. For a lot of most of the vendors that we've been dealing with so far, there's been some way to deal with this problem, but it is a good thing to let them know up front to expect and to build into the process. This is not actually a sub-bullet, but the CAVP permits an honor system right now approach to algorithm testing, and that honor system approach is just not workable in this case. And so, You can't really ask somebody, I think, to do something like, well, give me this many traces under these conditions, and then we'll go analyze them or something like that. And then you can sign some kind of assertion that says you've done this in a legally binding way or something along these lines. You really have to do this yourself. You have to work with the vendors in order to be able to have control of that system so that you can execute this. It's a little different in terms of the options that you have for your situations. So when you do interact with the vendors, if there are unsatisfactory findings, I think here, you know, people don't, you know, everyone experiences in a regulatory business that, you know, you have to give people some bad news. And when you give them some bad news, I think they want to know what they can do about it or what recourse they have at that point. And so, that interaction is one where it certainly is helpful to have, you know, a lot of good information at the ready to be able to help them understand and at least provide some reasonable guidance to the vendors about what the next steps are. And so, again, that's a matter of background in all these kinds of things. I think the more you've done it, I think the more you have the ability to help them through that process. Gilbert touched on I've labeled this false and negatives, and I think it's really both false positive and negative to be concerned about. The TVLA process is more susceptible to a false positive, and I think, you know, that's the idea of, did you not even connect this thing at all, and so it looks great. You know, you're not seeing anything in there. And so, in contrast to the CAVP process, that is likely to result in a false negative. So if something was not done properly, you're not going to get the right answers, more likely. So in some cases, you certainly won't get the right answer. In the case of the TVLA, you've really got to convince yourself that what you've done is legitimate and it's something that you can stand behind. So in that, you have to do some task to assure some kind of passing result is valid. So one of those methods is to demonstrate leakage impact of enabling and disabling countermeasures. I mean, that to me, as someone, I feel much more confident when you can really show people, this is what we get when the countermeasures are on, this is what we get when the countermeasures are off. But that's not very realistic for the most part. So instead, you have to find some other methods of demonstrating leakage, for example, in I/O, to provide some confidence. We have had some vendors who, at the level of the chip vendors, are willing to do that kind of thing for characterization purposes. They're willing to enable and disable. And so you're doing something really at a kind of a different level. You're doing characterization and not necessarily what the end users are using. It's a helpful step along the way. But what we've had to do mostly is to look at I/O or other circumstances where we can show we really are getting a good trace captures. We're really doing the right things with cleaning up the signal to show that we're getting good results. So signal exploration failures could be a tester skill problem. And if you don't do that signal cleanup well, you can get misleading results. So for the interpretation of results, I think our position is that to say pass or fail from the level of the program that this is applied to is too simplistic. And we are talking about, of course, the things that are included with this, but like scoring systems. In order to do this, the vendor may need to disable what they have as effective countermeasures to even allow this process. So in that, it may be that they really are doing some quite effective things that really prevent you from doing that kind of work at all. And we're asking them to get rid of that so we can perform the testing. So the ability to perform those tests and the ability to perform these kinds of attacks in that case, you know, are also very important. As well, it may be hard to get a consistent leakage threshold agreed on in a program on this of this nature. It may be that there are some keys that whose lifespan are not very long or other things like that where it really does matter what context you're looking at this in. So we do find that the scoring systems are helpful to provide context, and in addition to the notion of having a scoring system which is about how hard is it to perform this attack, those scoring systems also have typically some methodology of saying, and if you do perform this attack, how valuable, you know, how exploitable is that? And I think those are two useful measures. We would like to see then, as people approach this, some periodic dialogue with industry and regulators and labs to establish the ground rules for interpretation of this type of thing. So we don't see that lab-to-lab kind of variance where somebody may look at the same material and say you pass and somebody else might look at that material and say you fail, you know, but we still don't see it as a black and white pass-fail as a result of seeing X sigma. Okay, so it's also, I think, one has to be a little bit cautious about drawing conclusions from simple leakage tests. I think in some things that we observed in our training processes, there was a tendency to want to say, early on, I'm not seeing leakage, I'm seeing these kinds of things happen, and so nothing's happening. And I think it's just a caution from our own experience that you really have to keep looking for positive indicators that you're doing this right and not being thrown off by early results, for example, or being thrown off by not enough examination of the unit under test. Now, the fixed versus varying test should help spot leakage. In that case, you do get a lot more confidence if you can see, you know, there's no leakage across all of this in a fixed versus varying. And within our group, we have had some debates about what the value of the additional specific tests are. I think our end conclusion is that additional information is helpful. It depends on the circumstances. There's a cost and time and resource implication to doing that, because you have to do more trace collection, and that trace collection will take up your equipment. You know, that's not necessarily going to be fast all the time in order to do that. So, you know, you have to think about things like having spare capacity in the equipment in order to perform this. You have to think about running it overnight. You have to think about slotting and scheduling, that type of thing. Now, on the good news front, I guess I've been saying maybe all the things that are our point of view about how this is a little different than maybe the ideal. But even though that comparison to something like the CAV CAVP testing is not completely apt, we think that something like TVLA is the right direction. If I go back to our early history of trying to do the work in the process of trying to find the keys and steal the keys, you would run into thresholds early on about just how much is this going to cost. In essence, you would go over some budgeted amounts that were sometimes program regulated before you even really got going in earnest. And if you're running into that, you're not doing enough of the practice and repetition that it takes to be good at it. So some middle ground like this, where it is more possible to do something within some time-bounded way is and budget-bounded way, is really helpful. So we found that this process itself, the notion of the process, is straightforward and constrained and good in that sense. Test vectors are predetermined and standardized and maintained. If we can get that to be the case, that's helpful. The fixed versus varying is a good sanity check. And in conclusion, the TVLA or something like it for compliance scenarios is a good direction, and we need to work for greater definition and support from the community, and by community I mean the industry, regulators, and labs. And finally, labs need to prepare tooling and training for a non-trivial new task as they approach this work. But it's actually, for our folks, they found it's kind of fun and exciting to be able to do this. I think it's been something that's interested the people who are doing work. It's a nice break from this type of thing. So with that, thanks. And I'm basically 30 seconds from out of time, so. Yeah, I understand, and I think the model I think of is our lab was just undergoing some EMV qualification. As a part of the process in this, when we did RF work, or when doing RF work, there is an analogous process that goes on with the reproducibility of results that's governed by a contractor, in that case, who is quite skilled at that exercise. And so I think it does take some program like that. I do mention it as a challenge from that perspective. You know, I don't think you can just ask somebody some questions about that type of thing and expect that you're going to know you're going to have good results across all the labs. Steve. Sure. And I think, you know, I tried to qualify that. I saw some skeptical looks as I said those words, and I get it. And I think there's cases where the vendors at the end of the whole process, you know, they have no idea how this chip is built or what those even those methodologies are, if they're at the chip level or whatever else might be going on. But there are circumstances as we work directly with chip vendors, for example, or people who are at the hardware levels, where there is willingness to do that, and there is some willingness to approach it as more of a characterization so they can learn how effective is this. And in that sense, it's more ideal if you can do that, because even to the degree of potentially turning individual measures off to see their effectiveness, Now, you know, some of these things are going to change if that's an FPGA implementation versus the final product, for example. And so they might want to repeat those types of things, you know, not just to make more money, but just to make sure that that type of thing is still okay. So I would say that has limited application, but you get, I think, a better quality of information if you can do that at the right time in the process.
It would be interesting to see, do it on an FPGA, turned on, turned off, and then see what the chip looks like, if it's comparable to the turned on app.
Yeah, you know that some of that stuff, depending on how it's implemented, is going to be a little bit different. You know, exactly what signal cleanup you're doing. I mean, I don't know, you probably have more experience with that kind of thing.
Yeah, brief follow-up to say that. Yeah, I mean, we have that issue because we use this as a way for us to develop our libraries and cores and make sure they're protected. Obviously, comparing an implementation that has a countermeasure versus one that doesn't have a countermeasure, they're completely different implementations. But if you have a masking countermeasure and you can disable the mask or set it always to be zero, so that its net effect falls away, then you get some real insight into what's going on, and so that can be pretty useful if a vendor can provide a switch that works like that. We see it internally testing our own design, so obviously there's that tighter loop, but it depends on what a vendor can provide in terms of switches and still feel confident that represents the final product.
Yes?
So we've written this up in terms of both first order and second order leakages. It does require some specification by the tester in terms of what regions of interest. If we do second order across an entire trace, it's very computationally intensive because of the sort of n squared over 2 factor. But if you choose a region spanning a few rounds and you say that one round's implementation is using the same code, same gates as another round, you can look for interference between them. And so that is written up into the specification. The threshold is a little bit higher for leakage there because 4.5 sigma is supposed to be 5/9 confidence, but if I have so many more test points because I'm doing two-dimensional, we pump it up a little bit higher to say 5 sigma, but it does essentially work straightforward with that type of processing.
Ready?
So would you have an answer also to Aaron's question about the qualification of test personnel?
Yes.
Just out of curiosity.
Also, two other ISO documents, 1996, part 1 and part 2, part 2 in particular, is the competency requirements for testers, which will include testers who are doing side channel testing.
Okay. There you have it.
I say that, you know, if we could do some sort of test artifact that everybody evaluates the same and can see some leakage that provides sort of a baseline at least for